Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. This week we present Deborah Berger, co-president of National Nurses United, who talks about her union's demand for adequate protection equipment for all frontline healthcare workers and sane government policies to address the pandemic. Harold Frazier, chairman of the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe in South Dakota, who explains why he's defying an order by the state's governor to remove checkpoints the tribe set up on highways to prevent the spread of the coronavirus. And Amanda Starbuck of Food and Water Watch, who examines how the COVID-19 pandemic has exposed the failings of the U.S. food system and her group's advocacy for structural change. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
While President Trump is blaming a Chinese laboratory for releasing the coronavirus, Beijing is focused on containing the pandemic and launching new diplomatic initiatives in the Persian Gulf and the Greater Middle East. According to El Monitor, China has fast-tracked shipments of protective equipment and test kits to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. Gulf states are embracing China's public health strategy to defeat the virus. If they're successful, it could allow the Gulf states to speed up the timeline for reopening their economies battered by the virus and the crash in the price of oil in recent months. In late April, Saudi Arabia agreed to pay $265 million to China for test kits. The agreement comes as the Trump administration is increasingly isolated from nations working collaboratively in Europe and Asia to respond to the COVID-19 pandemic. Now Saudi Arabia, with China's help, is eager to reopen the holy Muslim cities of Mecca and Medina. After 2 months of the coronavirus pandemic in the United States and a nearly 15% unemployment rate, former Vice President Joe Biden has opened up a single-digit lead in national polls over Donald Trump. Still, Trump, who is on live TV every day, has an advantage with large white populations in swing Midwestern states like Wisconsin. According to statistical analysis of polling by The Economist in March and April, Biden is ahead among key white voting groups when compared to Hillary Clinton 4 years ago. But the former vice president has soft support among progressive blocs, including voters under age 30, African Americans, and Latinos. The Economist's model found that if the election were held today, 51% of white voters would support Trump, with 41% favoring Biden. 4 years ago, Hillary Clinton lost the white vote by 15 points. At the same time, Biden is doing better among college-educated and working-class whites. Recent polls found that Biden is slightly ahead in the battleground states of Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. According to The Economist, Trump could lose the popular vote by 2-3% and still win the majority in the Electoral College. Progressive New York Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, or AOC, is facing a well-funded primary challenge from former CNBC correspondent Michelle Caruso Cabrera, who is backed by the right-wing U.S. Chamber of Commerce with funding from dozens of Wall Street financiers. A decade ago, Caruso Cabrera wrote a free market book where she attacked Medicare and Social Security as pyramid schemes. The foreword for the book was written by Larry Kudlow, now Trump's senior economic advisor. For years, the CNBC reporter lived in a Trump-owned building in Manhattan. Running in a Queens working-class district, Caruso Cabrera now defends Social Security and Medicare and attacks AOC for voting against a federal COVID-19 stimulus funding bill, which AOC criticized as inadequate. The former CNBC anchor says she decided to run against AOC after the congresswoman joined a coalition of Queens community activists to defeat planned public subsidies that would attract Amazon to locate its headquarters in the borough. Thus far, Caruso Cabrera has raised $1 million to the $3.5 million raised by AOC. The Democratic primary vote is scheduled for June 23rd. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
As the coronavirus continues to ravage the world, the case and death rate in the United States continues to climb, with 1.4 million confirmed cases and over 83,000 deaths as of May 12th. Despite the continuing increase in cases and deaths, many states are now reopening businesses with varying degrees of restrictions in place. But public health officials warn that the relaxation of social distancing and stay-at-home orders will likely lead to a new wave of infections and death. National Nurses United, the largest union of registered nurses in the U.S., marked this year's week honoring nurses, May 6th through 12th, with a series of protest actions demanding optimal COVID-19 personal protective equipment for nurses and all frontline healthcare workers. The union is also calling for widespread testing that the Trump regime promised but never delivered. Health experts maintain that an exponential increase in testing and contact tracing will be necessary to begin a safe, phased reopening of the economy. Your reporter spoke with Deborah Berger, co-president of National Nurses United, who discusses the union's demands for adequate protections for nurses and assesses federal and state policies addressing the coronavirus pandemic.
We have been lobbying the federal and state government. We've had numerous actions, job actions, and we've also had most recently actions at the White House to highlight the fact that despite our work in the last 3 months to get the equipment that we need, we're still having difficulty because our employers are saying that we have the protections we need, and now they're even recommending more egregious solutions to the lack of PPE by saying that it's okay to reuse those masks, it's okay to downgrade the safety precautions that the CDC has made. So there's a number of issues that we're still dealing with, and we're actually working with other community groups and supporters through the protectnurses.org to send petitions to the American Hospital Association and to President Trump to increase the use of the Defense Production Act for all the necessary equipment we need, including the N95 masks.
How would you assess the federal government's performance here, given that a lot of what the Trump administration has been doing has been very obviously chaotic, in many cases irrational? There have been certainly instances of contradictory statements coming out less than 24 hours apart. Sometimes the equipment is not forthcoming, despite assurances by President Trump early on 2 months ago that everyone who wants a test can get a test. Comment on some of the most important problems that you see in terms of coordination from the federal government.
If I was going to grade the Trump administration on their performance and handling of this epidemic, I would have to give it a failing grade. And in fact, I would send them back another grade so that they couldn't move forward, because they really are undermining the role of what a proper government response should be. There's continual happy talk about the role that the VA has and how well they're doing. They talk about how well the CDC is doing, how well the COVID-19 task force is doing. Yet when you actually look at the results that are the underpinnings for examining any response and giving it an honest grade, you have to say that they have missed the boat. We still don't have adequate testing for people that desperately need tests. They have actually stopped testing in some states and said that they're opening and don't need them. We still do not have the adequate PPE that we need, despite the fact that we are now 3 months into this pandemic and have not gotten the equipment that we need. There is less than adequate support and clear communication about how this pandemic should be treated. And the CDC itself, which is supposed to be an independent organization within the government giving honest recommendations, is still heavily lobbied by the hospital industry to weaken worker protections. And that's probably the most egregious part of this. In Canada, there has not been one nurse death as a result of the COVID-19 outbreak. Not one. In the United States, we now have over 100. And if we had the proper protections we needed, there would not be any death because we would be completely prepared to do the job without being exposed to this deadly virus.
What should the American people be demanding of the federal government and their state governments right now in terms of addressing this pandemic, which is far from over?
So what people should be demanding is that they follow the science and not the pocketbook of the employers or the federal government. They can go to protectnurses.org and sign our petitions so that they can actually help protect nurses, because if you don't protect nurses, we can't protect our patients. And then continue to do really good programming like this where you actually have the time to talk to nurses and other healthcare workers that are on the front lines at great sacrifice to their health and their family's health to keep you safe.
That was Deborah Berger, co-president of the National Nurses United Union. Learn more about the life and death challenges facing nurses during this pandemic by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Two Sioux tribes in South Dakota have set up checkpoints where highways cross their reservations in an effort to keep the coronavirus from infecting their people. South Dakota's Governor Kristi Noem has ordered tribal leaders to remove the checkpoints or face legal action. The Republican governor never enacted a stay-at-home order in her state. The Cheyenne River Sioux Reservation covers 5,000 square miles, slightly smaller than the state of Connecticut. 9 checkpoints have been set up, where travelers are asked to answer a health questionnaire, and any from a COVID-19 hotspot are asked to reroute their journey. However, all commercial, medical, and other essential workers are allowed to pass unhindered. Tribal Chairman Harold Frazier says his goal is to contain and track the virus, and adds that for his 12,000 members, there are only 8 beds in the tribe's on-site clinic, with the nearest critical care hospital a 3-hour drive away in Rapid City. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Chairman Frazier about the steps the tribe is taking to prevent the spread of the coronavirus and his response to the governor's threat.
Once we had one case in South Dakota, we got serious and we sat down and we started looking at what do we need to do? What can we do? And looking at the very minimal medical services facilities that are here on a reservation, we felt that prevention was one of the main things we can do. So we started planning around prevention. And as days went on, we started seeing and learning more. And I think the key to a virus is to try to isolate it, keep it contained, and don't let it spread. So, you know, we got to track this. We got to find it, you know. We decided the best thing to do is monitor who comes and goes through our home. So that's one of the main reasons that we put these checkpoints, to monitor and to track individuals coming and going, leaving our reservation. So the main thing is to try to, prevent death from coming to our people. We're just here to try to save lives.
So these checkpoints are set up on state highways that go through the reservation, is that right?
You know, in my opinion, these highways are maintained by the state, but they do not own them. We own all the land, so, you know, and I know that I have not seen any, and that's why I asked them, show me the deed, show me your right-of-way, show me this, you know, show me any legal document that says otherwise. Until you don't, we own them, you know.
Did the governor take any steps to protect people from the spread of the coronavirus?
She shut down the schools, which was really good. Her actions was non-essential. We were working from home, and the essential, you know, they were working. I thought they were good things. But other than that, she had done nothing else. We knew that by the state's so-called back to normal plan, we knew it was going to make it even a bigger challenge for us to maintain our course, because when one leaves the reservation and goes to, example, Rapid City or another place like that, they're like, and I heard reports back, hey, they ain't wearing masks, nothing, like nothing's going on, you know.
Harold Frazier, what kind of precautions are people taking on the reservation? And do people have access to masks and other things they need?
Yeah, there's quite a bit of people wear masks, whether they're, again, we've been pushing the CDC recommendation or the social distancing. We told them at the very beginning it was really hard to get a lot of supplies in, such as masks, gloves, etc. But now we got a pretty good supply of masks. But then people took it upon themselves, which is pretty awesome, that they started making their own masks out of cloth and stuff. So that was really good. And I believe that was a recommendation by CDC as well. It's better than nothing. So we've done a lot. Also, our businesses here. And we do weekly checks, monitoring on them. They all have plexiglass between the teller and the customer. We recommend, and they do follow it, that 10 customers in the store at a time, you know, things like that. And I noticed if you ever come to our reservation now, there's marks on the floor where they're measured 6 feet apart. So we've been, everybody stepped up and all doing their part, and it seems to be going real well.
Have you had any cases on the reservation?
We have had one positive case, but like I said, because of the checkpoint and the actions we're doing, we were able to isolate it quickly. Really fortunate that the contacts with the patient so far, the ones we have tested, come out negative, but they're all in quarantine, and it's doing quite well.
I've been reading that in the U.S. as a whole, indigenous folks are contracting the virus at a higher rate than the general population, but you seem to have nipped it in the bud.
Yeah, we're sure trying, you know. We're prepared if we get another case or even more, you know. We just don't want it to get like, I don't know if you have seen anything in relation to the Navajo Nation.
Yes, that's a terrible situation. Very high mortality rate. So you're not planning to change anything you're doing because it's working to protect people. But you expect the governor will initiate legal action if you don't remove the checkpoints?
Yeah, that's what they're saying. But, you know, it doesn't matter what they do. I'm confident, and everybody here, we're prepared to whatever comes our way.
That was Harold Frazier, chairman of the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe in South Dakota. Learn more about the tribe's effort to contain the coronavirus and their conflict with Governor Noem by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. When the coronavirus first struck the U.S., the response was varied across the country. But many Americans, fearing the unknown, stocked up on basic food items, as they would to prepare for a blizzard, a hurricane, or some other emergency. The result was empty store shelves, which generated panic buying and hoarding, further disrupting the nation's food supply chain. Another level of disruption occurred, as workers employed in meat processing plants, warehouses and grocery stores contracted the virus, causing industry shutdowns and shortages of certain products such as pork and beef. As the U.S. economy lost 20.5 million jobs in April, pushing the unemployment rate to 14.7%, millions of Americans without a job or a paycheck joined long lines at food banks. With a flood of people lining up for a box of basic groceries, food banks are now struggling to keep up with the demand. While increasing numbers of Americans go hungry, farmers and large agribusinesses are dumping milk and produce, breaking eggs and euthanizing livestock that they can no longer sell amid the coronavirus economic lockdown. Your reporter spoke with Amanda Starbuck, senior food researcher and policy analyst at Food and Water Watch. Here she discusses how the coronavirus pandemic has exposed the failures of the U.S. food system and her group's advocacy for structural change to improve worker safety as well as public and environmental health.
We go into, for instance, the grocery store, and nowadays things are a little bit different, but you rewind to a couple months ago and you just see all sorts of full shelves and you see thousands of different brands of every food that you can imagine. And it looks like we just have all these choices and there's all these companies out there. But in reality, a lot of the products that you see are owned by a few select companies. A lot of the meat that you produce, about 4 out of 5 every head of cattle that we slaughter in this country are slaughtered by the top 4 companies that control most of the market. We see a lot of market control and eggs as well, and dairy. And so really, as consumers and as the people who grow our food as well, there has just been a chokehold, a lot of power, and it has only gotten worse over the years, has really been concentrated into a few major players. We can, go about our daily lives and not necessarily experience it, but what this pandemic has really kind of shown is how vulnerable this sort of food system is. You know, you have a single hog processing plant, for instance, in Iowa or in South Dakota closes down, and that wipes out immediately 5% of the entire hog processing capacity of the whole country. A few decades before, you might have smaller, more independent processes that you could take your hogs to. So if you had one closed down, you might have alternative arrangements. But now you have farmers, unfortunately, euthanizing their herds because they no longer have any other market to take their hogs to. And so it's finally, I think, coming to a point where it's becoming more and more difficult for consumers and for our lawmakers to really ignore the problems and how vulnerable we've allowed our food system to become over the years.
Amanda, as our listeners are aware, President Trump issued orders to keep these vital meatpacking plants open despite the fact that they are an extremely frightening vector for infections mm-hmm. in many states across the country. Whether they be Tyson or Smithfield or any number of these large conglomerates that provide the bulk of U.S. meat products for our supermarkets. What's your response to President Trump issuing an order to keep these meat plants open, despite the fact that the safety procedures are obviously not up to snuff, and keeping these plants open certainly risks many employees' lives?
No, it absolutely is. It was the wrong decision to make. You know, until these plants can actually have, requirements in place for social distancing, can prove that they're actually looking out for their workers, I don't think they should be opening. And unfortunately, it seems to be a decision that was made more to help the businesses themselves rather than the workers or the consumers. These companies export about 30% of their hogs abroad. And they're continuing to export, even into this month, as they complain about, we're going to run out of meat, they're still selling it to markets such as China. So I really think that decision was made to pander to these big corporations at the risk of the health and safety of the workers and at the risk of the health and safety of the rest of the country as this pandemic continues to spread.
Amanda, how can the federal government intervene here to reroute food that is being destroyed, whether it's meat or milk or cheese or other products that are not being sold in the regular market that they're used to, but get this food to the people who are lined up at food banks who desperately need it? Is there a role for the federal government during this crisis?
Oh, there absolutely is. Yeah, we actually called for the National Guard to help with that rerouting. And actually, that's happened on certain scales in some communities where the National Guard has helped step in to pack food boxes at food pantries, for instance. But they could also help with distributing from, the farm to the pantry to begin with. But yeah, I think the federal government does have a role, and there has been there is money being used to help purchase food and bring it to food banks. We're just concerned that, you know, if it's going to be anything like the trade war bailout, JBS, which is a Brazilian meat processing company, came out the biggest winner of that package. And so we're just afraid that, you know, are the big players going to be the ones that are going to be given the best treatment, or is this money, you know, to purchase food from farms actually going to go to the smaller farms to keep them afloat as well? But yes, absolutely. I think that the government should continue that and should, you know, help as much as they can so this food isn't wasted and so that hungry people can eat.
Amanda, review for our listeners some of the important changes that you feel our government should address here, the failings that have been exposed in this pandemic, and maybe also discuss how this could be a topic of debate in the coming presidential election campaign.
We need to look at the big picture, right? So we can address these issues as they come. We can try to pump more and more money into meeting the immediate needs of people, which we should be doing, immediate needs so people can be fed. But we can't ignore what brought us to this situation in the first place. We can't ignore the fact that we have allowed this food system to be run by corporations for the past few decades at the risk of our environment, at the risk of our workers, at the detriment of our farmers and our rural communities. And so I think we really do need to put this at the forefront. And there has been, you know, there was encouragingly a few of the Democratic candidates did have some stronger farm policies than we've seen in recent years. You know, Cory Booker, for instance, with the Farm System Reform Act, but also Senator Warren brought up some issues about supply management, and that ties into factory farms as well. And so I think I'm encouraged that these issues are becoming more to the forefront. And I'm really hoping that once life goes back to whatever normal it'll return to, that we don't forget what's happening here and that we can really kind of keep carrying these conversations forward.
That was Amanda Starbuck, senior food researcher and policy analyst at Food and Water Watch. Find more news and analysis on how the pandemic is impacting the U.S. food chain by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on eJazz Radio in Kampala, Uganda, WHYR in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, KKRN in Round Mountain, California, and dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.